Chapter 48. The Junkra, the Bride, and the Piano. We located ourselves at the Junkra Hotel, one of those huge establishments which the needs of modern travel have created in every attractive spot on the continent. There was a great gathering at dinner, and, as usual, one heard all sorts of languages. The table d'hôte tea was served by waitresses dressed in the quaint and comely costume of the Swiss peasants. This consists of a simple gros de laine, trimmed with ashes of roses, with overskirt of scare blue venter Saint Chris, cut bias on the offside, with facings of petit polonaise and narrow insertions of pas carotte de folie gras backstitched to the mise en scène backquote ne in the form of a Jew desperate. It gives to the wearer a singularly piquant and alluring aspect. One of these waitresses, a woman of 40, had side whiskers reaching halfway down her jaws. They were 2 fingers broad, dark in color, pretty thick, and the hairs were an inch long. One sees many women on the continent with quite conspicuous mustaches, but this was the only woman I saw who had reached the dignity of whiskers. After dinner, the guests of both sexes distributed themselves about the front porches and the ornamental grounds belonging to the hotel to enjoy the cool air. But, as the twilight deepened toward darkness, they gathered themselves together in that saddest and solemnest and most constrained of all places, the great blank drawing room which is the chief feature of all continental summer hotels. There they grouped themselves about, in couples and threes, and mumbled in bated voices, and looked timid and homeless and forlorn. There was a small piano in this room, a clattery, wheezy, asthmatic thing, certainly the very worst miscarriage in the way of a piano that the world has seen. In turn, 5 or 6 dejected and homesick ladies approached it doubtingly, gave it a single inquiring thump, and retired with the lockjaw. But the boss of that instrument was to come, nevertheless, and from my own country, from Arkansas. She was a brand new bride, innocent, girlish, happy in herself and her grave, and worshipping stripling of a husband. She was about 18, just out of school, free from affections, unconscious of that passionless multitude around her. And the very first time she smote that old wreck, one recognized that it had met its destiny. Her stripling brought an armful of aged sheet music from their room, for this bride went heeled, as you might say, and bent himself lovingly over, and got ready to turn the pages. The bride fetched a swoop with her fingers from one end of the keyboard to the other, just to get her bearings, as it were, and you could see the congregation set their teeth with the agony of it. Then, without any more preliminaries, she turned on all the horrors of the Adel of Prague, that venerable chivalry, and waded chin deep in the blood of the slain. She made a fair and honorable average of 2 false notes in every 5, but her soul was in arms, and she never stopped to correct. The audience stood it with pretty fair grit for a while, but when the cannonade waxed hotter and fiercer, and the discord average rose to 4 in 5, the procession began to move. A few stragglers held their ground 10 minutes longer, but when the girl began to wring the true inwardness out of the eyes of the wounded, they struck their colors and retired in a kind of panic. There never was a completer victory. I was the only non-combatant left on the field. I would not have deserted my countrywoman anyhow, but indeed I had no desires in that direction. None of us like mediocrity, but we all reverence perfection. This girl's music was perfection in its way. It was the worst music that had ever been achieved on our planet by a mere human being. I moved up close, and never lost a strain. When she got through, I asked her to play it again. She did it with a pleased alacrity and a heightened enthusiasm. She made it all discords, this time. She got an amount of anguish into the cries of the wounded that shed a new light on human suffering. She was on the warpath all the evening. All the time, crowds of people gathered on the porches and pressed their noses against the windows to look and marvel, but the bravest never ventured in. The bride went off satisfied and happy with her young fellow, when her appetite was finally gorged, and the tourists swarmed in again. What a change has come over Switzerland, and in fact all Europe, during this century. 70 or 80 years ago, Napoleon was the only man in Europe who could really be called a traveler. He was the only man who had devoted his attention to it, and taken a powerful interest in it. He was the only man who had traveled extensively. But now everybody goes everywhere, and Switzerland, and many other regions which were unvisited, and unknown remotenesses 100 years ago, are in our days a buzzing hive of restless strangers every summer. But I digress. In the morning, when we looked out of our windows, we saw a wonderful sight. Across the valley, and apparently quite neighborly, and close at hand, the giant form of the Jungfrau rose cold and white into the clear sky, beyond a gateway in the nearer islands. It reminded me, somehow, of one of those colossal billows which swell suddenly up beside one's ship, at sea, sometimes, with its crest and shoulders snowy white, and the rest of its noble proportions streaked downward with creamy foam. I took out my sketchbook, and made a little picture of the Jungfrau, merely to get the shape. Figure 9, I do not regard this as one of my finished works, in fact I do not rank it among my works at all. It is only a study. It is hardly more than what one might call a sketch. Other artists have done me the grace to admire it, but I am severe in my judgments of my own pictures, and this one does not move me. It was hard to believe that that lofty wooded rampart on the left which so overtops the Jungfrau was not actually the higher of the two, but it was not, of course. It is only 2,000 or 3,000 feet high, and of course has no snow upon it in summer, whereas the Jungfrau is not much shorter of 14,000 feet high, and therefore that lowest verge of snow on her side, which seems nearly down to the valley level, is really about 7,000 feet higher up in the air than the summit of that wooded rampart. It is the distance that makes the deception. The wooded height is but 4 or 5 miles removed from us, but the Jungfrau is 4 or 5 times that distance away. Walking down the street of shops, in the forenoon, I was attracted by a large picture, carved, frame and all, from a single block of chocolate-colored wood. There are people who know everything. Some of these had told us that continental shopkeepers always raise their prices on English and Americans. Many people had told us it was expensive to buy things through a courier, whereas I had supposed it was just the reverse. When I saw this picture, I conjectured that it was worth more than the friend I proposed to buy it for would like to pay, but still it was worthwhile to inquire. So I told the courier to step in and ask the price, as if he wanted it for himself. I told him not to speak in English, and above all not to reveal the fact that he was a courier. Then I moved on a few yards, and waited. The courier came presently, and reported the price. I said to myself, it is 100 francs too much, and so dismissed the matter from my mind. But in the afternoon I was passing that place with Harris, and the picture attracted me again. We stepped in to see how much higher broken German would raise the price. The shopwoman named a figure just 100 francs lower than the courier had named. This was a pleasant surprise. I said I would take it. After I had given directions as to where it was to be shipped, the shopwoman said, appealingly, "If you please, do not let your courier know you bought it." This was an unexpected remark. I said, "What makes you think I have a courier?" "Ah, that is very simple," he told me himself. He was very thoughtful. "But tell me, why did you charge him more than you are charging me?" "That is very simple, also. I do not have to pay you a percentage." "Oh, I begin to see. You would have had to pay the courier a percentage." "Undoubtedly. The courier always has his percentage. In this case it would have been 100 francs. Then the tradesman does not pay a part of it, the purchaser pays all of it?" There are occasions when the tradesman and the courier agree upon a price which is twice or thrice the value of the article. Then the two divide, and both get a percentage.
I see.
But it seems to me that the purchaser does all the paying, even then.
Oh, to be sure.
It goes without saying. But I have bought this picture myself. Therefore, why shouldn't the courier know it?
The woman exclaimed, in distress.
Ah, indeed it would take all my little profit. He would come and demand his 100 francs, and I should have to pay.
He has not done the buying.
You could refuse.
I could not dare to refuse.
He would never bring travelers here again.
More than that, he would denounce me to the other couriers.
They would divert custom from me, and my business would be injured.
I went away in a thoughtful frame of mind.
I began to see why a courier could afford to work for $55 a month and his fares.
A month or two later, I was able to understand why a courier did not have to pay any board and lodging, and why my hotel bills were always larger when I had him with me than when I left him behind, somewhere, for a few days.
Another thing was also explained now, apparently. In one town I had taken the courier to the bank to do the translating when I drew some money. I had sat in the reading room till the transaction was finished. Then a clerk had brought the money to me in person, and had been exceedingly polite, even going so far as to precede me to the door and holding it open for me, and bow me out, as if I had been a distinguished personage. It was a new experience. Exchange had been in my favor ever since I had been in Europe, but just that one time. I got simply the face of my draft, and no extra francs, whereas I had expected to get quite a number of them. This was the first time I had ever used the courier at the bank. I had suspected something then, and as long as he remained with me afterward, I managed bank matters by myself. Still, if I felt that I could afford the tax, I would never travel without a courier, for a good courier is a convenience whose value cannot be estimated in dollars and cents. Without him, travel is a bitter harassment, a purgatory of little exasperating annoyances, a ceaseless and pitiless punishment, I mean, to an irascible man who has no business capacity and is confused by details. Without a courier, travel hasn't a ray of pleasure in it, anywhere. But with him, it is a continuous and unruffled delight. He is always at hand, never has to be sent for. If your bell is not answered promptly, and it seldom is, you have only to open the door and speak. The courier will hear, and he will have the order attended to raise an insurrection. You tell him what day you will start, and whither you are going, leave all the rest to him. You need not inquire about trains, or fares, or car changes, or hotels, or anything else. At the proper time he will put you in a cab or an omnibus, and drive you to the train or the boat. He has packed your luggage and transferred it. He has paid all the bills. Other people have preceded you half an hour, to scramble for impossible places, and lose their tempers, but you can take your time. The courier has secured your seats for you, and you can occupy them at your leisure. At the station, the crowd mash one another to pulp in the effort to get the weigher's attention to their trunks. They dispute hotly with these tyrants, who are cool and indifferent. They get their baggage billets, at last, and then have another squeeze and another rage over the disheartening business of trying to get them recorded and paid for, and still another over the equally disheartening business of trying to get near enough to the ticket office to buy a ticket. And now, with their tempers gone to the dogs, they must stand penned up and packed together, laden with wraps and satchels and shawl straps, with the weary wife and babies, in the waiting room, till the doors are thrown open, and then all hands make a grand final rush to the train, find it full, and have to stand on the platform and fret until some more cars are put on. They are in a condition to kill somebody by this time. Meantime, you have been sitting in your car, smoking, and observing all this misery in the extremest comfort.
On the journey the guard is polite and watchful, won't allow anybody to get into your compartment, tells them you are just recovering from the smallpox and do not like to be disturbed. For the courier has made everything right with the guard. At way stations the courier comes to your compartment to see if you want a glass of water or a newspaper or anything. At eating stations he sends luncheon out to you, while the other people scramble and worry in the dining rooms. If anything breaks about the car you are in, and a station master proposes to pack you and your agent into a compartment with strangers, the courier reveals to him confidentially that you are a French duke born deaf and dumb, and the official comes and makes affable signs that he has ordered a choice car to be added to the train for you. At custom houses the multitude file tediously through, hot and irritated, and look on while the officers burrow into the trunks and make a mess of everything, but you hand your keys to the courier and sit still. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.